Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for April 2009. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. This podcast deals with two issues of patent law from opposite sides of the Atlantic Ocean. In the first half of this podcast, we will be discussing what constitutes an enabling disclosure under UK patent law, as defined by the House of Lords in the recent Lundbeck decision. In the second half of this podcast, we will be discussing the patentability of software and business method patents in the United States in the wake of the Bilski decision. My first guest for this podcast is Rowan Freeland. Rowan is a UK solicitor and partner in the firm of Simmons & Simmons in London, England. Rowan has had significant experience in UK patent litigation. Chambers Guide to the Legal Profession describes him as one of the best patent litigators in London. Lundbeck is a pharmaceutical company that makes and sells the largest selling antidepressant medicine, Cipralex. The active compound in Cipralex is covered by a UK patent that came under attack by several generic drug companies. There was no question that Cipralex was novel and inventive. The only issue was whether the Lundbeck patent should be declared invalid because its disclosure was allegedly insufficient. On February 25, 2009, the UK House of Lords ruled that the Lundbeck patent's disclosure was sufficient and the patent was valid. The decision adds much clarity to the UK law in this area. Rowan Freeland's firm acted as solicitors for Lundbeck. I spoke with Rowan from his office in London, England. Hello, Rowan.
Hello, Don.
Tell me about the Lundbeck decision.
It was a case about insufficiency, or one might say enablement, and how insufficiency relates to the breadth of claim. The basic holding was that if you discover a way to make a product, then you can claim the product itself, provided that the product is new and inventive, even though the only clever bit in your invention is the process for making it.
What were the facts in the Lundbeck case?
Citalopram is a racemic compound. In other words, it's made of an equal mixture of stereoisomers. We call them enantiomers, and they're molecules which look like two different hands. In other words, they have reflective symmetry, but you can't put one on top of the other. It is known that frequently one enantiomer in a racemic mixture is a better therapeutically than the other, and so it is desirable to, as they say, resolve or separate out the enantiomers. And sometimes that's easy, and sometimes that's difficult. With citalopram, it was very difficult. It took Lundbeck many years to find a technique. They actually had to go two steps back up the synthetic route and to use some chemistry which had never been used for this purpose in order to make a pure enantiomer. And they, once they'd managed to make the two different enantiomers, they tested them, found escitalopram was the good one, and they applied for a patent on that.
The Lundbeck court went to great lengths to distinguish this case from the 1997 decision in Biogen and Mediva. What was the Biogen test for sufficiency?
I think it's probably best to talk, first of all, in the case of Biogen, about this sort of the basic thing. Biogen was about the recombinant techniques for making hepatitis B antigen. The inventor disclosed only one technique to make only one hepatitis B antigen in only one type of bacterium. But the claim covered any technique to make any hepatitis B antigen in any host. So the disclosure by the inventor could not be generalized to enable all the embodiments that would fall within that wider claim. So the Biogen patent was in fact invalid for classic insufficiency. However, Lord Hoffman went on in his judgment to say two other things which gave rise to what we call Biogen insufficiency. first of all, he expressed concern that the scope of the claim of the Biogen patent went beyond the technical contribution to the art which the inventor had made. This is in itself a perfectly conventional statement of the law. It's based on the Exxon Fuel Oils case in the European Patent Office. But it was misinterpreted by people reading Hoffman's judgment to say that it's not that the claims should not go beyond the inventive concept, i.e., the clever part of what the inventor had done. And so where you have a clever process, you could never then claim the product of that process because the claims should only relate to the inventive concept. But that's not what Hoffman said. Hoffman said technical contribution. And the technical contribution is where you get using the inventive concept. That's the first thing that Hoffman said. The second thing that Hoffman said is that that where you have a desideratum which is known to people in the art, it's something which people in a particular art have been trying to do but have been unable to succeed, the first person to succeed is not entitled to claim the result. He can only claim his way of getting to the result. And Hoffman justified that by saying that otherwise his claim to the result would prevent other people who use different ways of getting to the result, which owed nothing to the technique taught by the patentee, it would prevent those other people from using those different techniques. And so that statement by Hoffman was interpreted as a derogation from the general rule that you can have patents for a product so long as the product is new and inventive and you've taught how to make it. And so where you had cases where the inventor had taught the art how to make something which the art had been trying to make, and in the Lundbeck case, what the art had been trying to make was one of the two enantiomers from the racemic mixture of citalopram. If somebody taught how to make it, then all they could claim was their way of making it. You couldn't actually claim the result. In the Lundbeck case, first of all in the Court of Appeal and then in the House of Lords, Lord Hoffman in the Court of Appeal said Biogen, in this extended meaning, has misinterpreted what Lord Hoffman said, that the Biogen rule is just the basic classic insufficiency case, that there are more ways of there are things falling within the claim which the disclosure in the specification does not enable, so classic insufficiency. And that's all that Biogen was saying, and attempts to turn that on its head and say, if there are other ways of getting there which are not disclosed, then the claim is bad, but that was wrong. That judgment in the Court of Appeal in Lundbeck then went up to the House of Lords, and the House of Lords endorsed that decision. They said that the Biogen case was a classic insufficiency case. You have to tell people how to make anything falling within the claim. And where you have a disclosure of a general principle, which is applicable to a wide class of products, then you can claim a wide class. But if you have a Biogen situation where you teach a sui generis technique, but claim the result of other techniques as well, that's just ordinary insufficiency. And the dictum from Lord Hoffman that said it's a bad thing to have a claim which prevents people from using techniques not taught in the patent, that's just a dictum by Hoffman. It's not part of the ratio, and that is not part of English law.
So in Lundbeck, the court decided that the technical contribution was the isolated enantiomer, correct?
They said, whereas the Biogen claim had process elements, which supported some of the Hoffman dicta, the Lundbeck claim was simply to a product. In fact, the Lundbeck claim was to one particular product, escitalopram. They didn't even claim any substitutions on the molecule. And where there is just one product and they've told you how to make it, that's all you need. The fact that there may be other ways of making it is irrelevant to a product claim, because you only need to enable a product claim once, and then people downstream who invent other ways of making it can get patents on their processes. But those will be subordinate patents, and they'll need a license from Lundbeck for the escitalopram product.
One of the aspects of this decision that I found most interesting was the involvement of Lord Hoffman. He wrote the Biogen decision. He dropped down to the Court of Appeal to decide Lundbeck. He couldn't be on the House of Lords panel to decide the appeal from his own decision, yet the reasons are full of comments on Lord Hoffman.
Yes, indeed. And Lord Hoffman is the great law lord with knowledge of patent law. And he was never a patent specialist originally, but he's acquired tremendous knowledge about it. And he's given a series of leading patent decisions over time. Biogen was one of them. The problem is he's coming to the end of his career and coming up to his retirement age. And the understanding is that he came down to take the Lundbeck case in the Court of Appeal because he was conscious that the Lundbeck case involved an analysis of his judgment in Biogen, and he wanted to be part of the clarification of what he meant in Biogen. And he said his judgment in Biogen had been misread by people. And the reason why he came down to the Court of Appeal to do that is understood to be that he was concerned that if he allowed the case to come up to the House of Lords in the ordinary way, he may have retired before he had an opportunity to hear it. So he decided it in the Court of Appeal. Rumor also has it, although I don't know whether it's true, that the reason why the House of Lords took the appeal is that Lord Hoffman privately suggested that it would be a good idea. And I don't know whether that's right or not, but it's an interesting story. And the House of Lords judges paid enormous deference to the opinion of Lord Hoffman. And so lying behind it is just a slight feeling that if it had not been somebody quite so great, I think they would have criticized what he said in his judgment, particularly the two extensions which I talked about earlier, which led to Biogen insufficiency. I think they would have criticized him for what he said there as taking English law in a wrong direction. As it was, what they said was that his, as he said in the Court of Appeal, his judgment had been misunderstood, and that the real ratio was that Biogen was just a classic insufficiency case. So his shadow lies long over the decisions of the House of Lords, and I think they were very careful to preserve his judgment in Biogen. There was no suggestion that on the facts of Biogen his judgment was wrong, but I think where we ended up is with the feeling that there are unlikely to be any other sets of facts where the Biogen principle is going to be applicable. So in the most tactful possible way, I think we can see that the House of Lords in Lundbeck confined the Biogen case to its particular facts.
What does the Lundbeck decision tell us about where the UK courts are heading in their consideration of the validity of patents?
Well, the English courts have for a number of years had a reputation of being anti-patent. And we've seen that in the fact that a significant number of cases in England have been started by putative infringers seeking to get patents revoked because the English courts are seen as the easiest jurisdiction to knock out patents. And the Lundbeck case in the Court of Appeal in the House of Lords is an example of the English courts moving the law in a pro-patentee direction. There have been a number of decisions like that, and most significantly earlier last year, the decision in Connor against Angiotech, where the application of conventional arguments as to obviousness by the courts below, which led to the patent being revoked, was said by the House of Lords to be wrong, and the patent was upheld. And that was a clear indication that the English courts were being too tough on patents. The Lundbeck case carries that forward. Again, it's a pro-patentee decision. And I think it's an exciting time as an English patent lawyer that over the last year, I think I've actually seen my advice to clients changing, even on the same fact. That whereas a year ago I'd have said, you know, a case was a strong case for knocking out a patent, I am much more cautious now. And that is the result of judgments like Connor, and Lundbeck is the most recent judgment in that series. So it's moving English law back towards being more even-handed between patentees and infringers. And that's a good thing.
Thank you for these insights, Rowan.
Well, Don, it's been very interesting talking to you. Thank you very much.
Moving now to the American side of the Atlantic. On October 30, 2008, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit issued its decision in the case of In re Bilski. The Bilski patent application claimed a business method invention, a method for hedging against increased future costs of a commodity. The CAFC ruled that the Bilski method was not a patentable process, principally because it did not transform a particular article into a different state or thing. In January 2009, the Finnegan firm filed a petition for a writ of certiorari on behalf of Bilski, asking the U.S. Supreme Court to overturn the CAFC decision. Robert Yakas is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Finnegan, Henderson, Faribault, Garrett, and Dunner, LLP. Bob has extensive experience prosecuting and litigating U.S. software and business method patents. His clients have included Nortel, Hewlett-Packard, and Xerox. His expertise in this area has also been noted by his inclusion in Best Lawyers in America. I spoke with Bob Yakas about Bilski and its effect on the patentability of software and business methods. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Don.
Just how significant is the Bilski decision to the thousands of U.S. software and business method patents that have been granted?
It's critically important. It has two effects. One is it's already been applied to invalidate patents that were in suit, and moreover, companies that have patent portfolios based upon software and business method inventions are now having to reevaluate their portfolios, both to determine whether or not those patents have any more value or whether they can do something perhaps to improve their value.
What test did Bilski impose for the patentability of processes?
Bilski imposed a test called the machine or transformation test, which essentially means that if you have a method claim, it either has to recite in a meaningful way a machine as part of the method, or it has to define a transformation of matter from one state into another.
I understand that the court set out a number of corollaries to the test. One was that the machine or transformation must impose a meaningful limitation on the claim.
Right. And the meaningful limitation is shorthand for what we used to talk about, insignificant post-solution activity or mere data gathering. In other words, if you include a machine merely to gather data or perhaps to display the result, that's not a meaningful limitation. If you do the transformation, really is more of a field of use limitation. That won't work either.
They also said that the process had to transform physical objects or substances. What did they mean by that?
The court was drawing a distinction between data that represented physical objects and data that represented things like legal obligations. You could, in the case of the In re Abelli case, which they cited with authority, do the transformation on data that actually representing something physical. In that case, it was a CRT display that was being manipulated to remove aliasing. Or similarly, in the arrhythmia case, the data was representing the electrocardiogram. But in the case of Bilski, there was something transformed, which may be generally considered legal obligations, in this case to arbitrate. But that didn't count because that's too abstract. So the transformation was being limited to either something that was essentially physical or something, some data that represented something physical.
Since Bilski, have any courts dealt with whether or not a process that transforms data representing money constitutes transforming something physical?
They haven't, but the State Street case said that money was real, and I suspect that's still good law because it wasn't rejected by the Bilski case. And in State Street, what the court said was, listen, you're dealing with shares. Shares represent money. They represent value. They're kind of halfway, I guess, between a legal obligation and something physical. But the point is that they're physical enough that you can get taxed on it, and that seemed to be significant to the court at the time. So my suggestion is, my feeling, I guess, is that money was physical enough.
Henry Comiskey was a case dealing with a method and system for mandatory arbitration. Why did the court apply Bilski to system claims?
Well, who knows, but the history of Comiskey was it was actually considered before Bilski, and the court had rejected the Comiskey claims under a slightly different modification of the machine transformation rule, but essentially what we used to call the mental steps doctrine, which said that the method claims could be performed merely by a person using a pencil and paper, and in that case, that's not patentable subject matter. It did, however, say that the system claims met the requirements of 101 and had actually remanded them back, not for determination of subject matter patentability, but it remanded them back for obviousness. The applicant in this case, Mr. Comiskey, sought a rehearing en banc from the entire Federal Circuit on the issue, and the entire court decided to let the panel take a look at this issue again. They went back and said, well, listen, we think that the method claim stuff is okay because even though we didn't say exactly what Bilski wanted, we essentially said that. But on the apparatus claims, maybe we were a bit too hasty in determining that these claims necessarily pass muster under 101. Let's send that back to the Patent Office, see what they say. Now, that's going to be interesting because the Patent Office, since Bilski, has been uniformly saying that system claims, which are essentially a general-purpose computer executing a method, should also be examined under the Bilski test. So my guess is that the Patent Office is going to come back and suggest that the Bilski test applies to system claims, and then the issue is going to be squarely in front of the Federal Circuit.
You've described the position being taken by the U.S. Patent Office following Bilski as being evidence of a full-scale war by the Patent Office on computer software claims. How so?
If you look at the cases that the Board of Patent Appeals and Interferences have decided in the past 4 or 5 months, they have gone out of their way to find anything at all related to business methods or software invalid. They have, in some cases, admitted that Bilski didn't hold this, but they think it should. In other cases, they've just ignored Bilski, and they have uniformly struck down a number of claims. For example, there's a type of claim called a Beauregard claim, which the Federal Circuit has blessed, and the Beauregard claim allows under 101, the subject matter patentability part of the statute, claims to a recording medium such as a disk that contains a program. The analysis by the Board of Patent Appeals now, again in applying Bilski, saying, well, listen, even though that's not a method, I don't see how that's any different because you still have a program on there that doesn't do transformation and there's no machine required, and therefore it fails the Bilski test. So there have been cases that have struck that down. There have been other cases which have taken a look at apparatus claims that they say are nothing more than a general-purpose computer executing a method that the method itself would fail Bilski, and if the method fails Bilski, their logic is that a computer that executes a method must also not be patentable subject matter. So the Patent Office in the last 4 or 5 months has taken an extreme position in every case in finding claims invalid under 101.
And I take it that business method patent applications are suffering even more?
It's true. Indeed, I'm not sure, and since November when BILSCO decided, there's been one claim to what you would consider a business method patent that survived the board. So, and the allowance rate already is down at about 15%. So even though the Federal Circuit can say that there's no longer such a thing called as the business method rejection, the patent office is rejecting essentially all business method patents by another name.
A petition for cert has been filed with the Supreme Court. What do you expect the timeline to be as to if or when the Supreme Court might address Bilski?
Well, the petition has been filed and several amici have been filed as well, too. There was recently an order from the Supreme Court giving the government, which is really the Patent Office, the other side, another month extension of time to reply. So their reply is until May. After that time, if the court grants cert, it'll set a briefing schedule, which typically will mean that the court will be ready to hear the case sometime in fall of 2009, maybe even as late as the winter.
Do you believe that the new Obama administration is going to have an effect on the U.S. Patent Office's attitude towards the patentability of business method and software inventions?
Well, I hope it will have a tempering effect. The two commissioners that the former President Bush appointed were less interested, I think, in making sure that there was a strong patent system in which people had good protection and more interested in issues of efficiency. And I give you as an example that the patent office rules that they promulgated, which were clearly designed to make running the patent office more efficient at the expense of allowing patent applicants to claim their inventions in an appropriate manner. And what happened with the business method patents, if you recall, several years ago, they instituted a mandatory review, quality review for every business method patent, which was unheard of and certainly probably unwarranted, but existed because those were the patents that were making news. And as a result of that, there was a drastic and dramatic fall off in the allowance rate of business method patents. Now, as I think I mentioned before, the allowance rate is, I think, below 15%, which is dreadful. And I think the general belief of those of us who are counseling companies and individuals who are applying for this type of patent is that the patent office is, or appears to be, arguing that they are doing their job and enforcing quality by virtue of the fact that the allowance rate is so low. And what the hope is that the Obama administration will appoint commissioners that have a different worldview of patents, and that their worldview of patents will be closer to what existed under President Clinton and the first President Bush, which was that the patent office's job is not solely to be the enemy of the patent applicant, but indeed to help patent applicants obtain strong and enforceable patents. And if they do that, then I think you'll see a shift in the attitude of the office in terms of both how they interpret subject matter patentability and how difficult they make it. Because right now, even before Bilski, in addition to the allowance rate, the delay in the patent office to get a business method patent is somewhere between 4 and 8 years. And if you have a patent that has any value in software and business methods and you have to wait 48 years, you essentially are denied any value for your inventions.
Thank you very much for these insights, Bob.
Well, I appreciate it. And Don, as always, it's a pleasure to talk to you about these matters.
My guests for this podcast were Rowan Freeland, a solicitor with the Simmons & Simmons firm in London, England, and Bob Yakas, a lawyer with the Finnegan Henderson firm in Washington, D.C. For further information regarding my guests, Mr. Freeland and Mr. Yakas, their respective law firms, the Lundbeck and Bilski decisions, and information on other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You have been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Cameron McKendrick LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.